Here on WEAA 88.9. I'm Sean Yoes, your host. Thank you for joining us for our first of 2 hours on this Thursday. Make sure to follow us on Twitter at First Edition 88.9, and don't forget to like and follow us on Facebook at First Edition on WEAA 88.9 FM. Go to WEAA.org on our homepage for the latest podcast of First Edition, or subscribe to our iTunes podcast, First Edition. Also, hit me up on my personal Twitter account. The tag is at Sean Yoes. That is my name, S-E-A-N-Y-O-E-S. Or go to my Facebook page. If you have information, insight, or breaking news you want to share with me, I'll share with the people unless you don't want me to, and I won't. Coming up in the second hour, it is the infamous, the notorious NWA Sports Report talking spring training, NBA All-Star Game, and whatever else we decide to jump into during the second hour on the NWA stand, in the second hour, First Edition. But before we get to the NWA, a very special first hour here on First Edition. In the studio with me is the president of Morgan State University, Dr. David Wilson. Dr. Wilson, welcome to the show. Good to see you.
Thank you, Sean. It's great being here.
Let's just jump right into it. Let's start with one element of today's, some people would say, meandering press conference that the 45th president gave. The issue of HBCUs did come up. I think it was April Ryan who asked him specifically about this alleged HBCU executive order that is supposed to be being crafted. He seemed to sidestep the issue, but obviously the larger issue, and one that I'm most curious to get your opinion on, is there is supposed to be a meeting between the Trump administration and several black college presidents. Allegedly scheduled for February 28th at the end of this month. First of all, are you familiar, in any official capacity, have you heard about that meeting? Do you know that that meeting is actually taking place?
Yes, I can confirm that the meeting is indeed going to take place.
Okay.
I would like just to take a minute to put into context the whole notion of executive orders.
Absolutely.
And how they came into existence with regard to HBCUs.
Absolutely.
Because what is being proposed by the current president is nothing new. The HBCU executive order creating the White House initiative on HBCUs actually started with former President Jimmy Carter.
Okay.
And each president after President Carter, Reagan, Bush 41, former President Clinton, Bush 43, and former President Obama, have all reauthorized that executive order. And so my understanding is that what the current president is working on is the continuation of that executive order that goes back to President Jimmy Carter.
And what's the substance of that order? What does it mean actually for HBCUs?
Basically what the order has said in the past is that there should be attention on the part of the federal agencies toward making strategic investments in HBCUs. And so when you look at agencies like the Department of Defense, the Department of Energy, NASA, but particularly many of the other federal agencies, the order is saying that those agencies should ensure that a certain percent of the funds that they oversee make their way to HBCUs to support research in those institutions and to support areas that are strategic to the mission of that particular agency. And so if you take like the Department of Defense, at the end of the day, you know, its mission is to support the soldier.
Right.
And so if there is research that can come out of Morgan or come out of North Carolina A&T or come out of any of the other HBCUs that would support that mission, the order is basically saying make sure that these institutions have access to a portion of those resources. Now, in the past, the unstated goal has been at least 5% of what a federal agency is overseeing. That has never happened.
We've never reached that threshold.
No, we've never reached that threshold. I think during my tenure on the board of the White House Initiative on HBCUs, I think we got up to about 2.5% or so. Trying to kind of understand what might be in this executive order, I'm hearing that there will be a stated goal of 5%. And I'm hearing that the initiative itself, the White House Initiative on HBCUs, that started, as I said, under President Jimmy Carter and was housed in the White House, with succeeding presidents, it was moved out of the White House into the Department of Education. Okay. And this executive order, I'm hearing, is bringing it back to the White House.
Okay. So back to the actual meeting that's supposed to take place on the 28th, were you officially invited?
So the proposed meeting now is to occur on February the 27th. Yes, and so there are two things that would be happening in Washington on the 27th and 28th. The 27th is when there's supposed to be a meeting at the White House, primarily with domestic policy advisors, and we were told that there is a possibility that the president would be a part of that in some way. And the purpose of that is to sit down with the domestic policy advisors in the White House and share with them the needs and opportunities for further investments in this genre of institutions that, quite frankly, gave rise to the black middle class in this country.
Of course.
And so then there is a full day scheduled on the 28th. These things are separate. That has been labeled an HBCU fly-in. Okay. On the 28th. And that actually is being sponsored by two Republican Congress people.
Senator Scott from South Carolina.
Yes.
And Representative Walker from North Carolina. Correct?
That's correct. Right. Senator Tim Scott and Congressman Walker from North Carolina. Right. Senator Scott from South Carolina. Mm-hmm. And we just got today as well confirmation that several of these individuals will be in attendance meeting with scores of HBCU presidents and chancellors. And my understanding is that all of the HBCU presidents and chancellors have been invited.
Okay.
We are represented in Washington by three national associations, HBCUs, or there's NAFEO, the National Association for Equal Opportunity in Higher Education. There's the Thurgood Marshall College Fund that represents all public HBCUs. NAFEO represents everyone, public and private. And then there is the United Negro College Fund that represents the private HBCUs. And so all of the public HBCU presidents and chancellors have been invited by way of the Thurgood Marshall College Fund.
Okay.
All the private ones, I understand, have been invited by way of the United Negro College Fund.
Mm-hmm. So are you going to attend?
I have thought about that for or at least the last couple of weeks or so, and I have registered. But along the way, I am still in consultation with a number of major constituents at Morgan.
Mm-hmm.
I am planning a dialogue with the members of the Morgan State University National Alumni Board and presidents of clubs. Also on Friday, I'm meeting with our student leaders to kind of hear their perspectives.
Sure.
On this as well. But at the end of the day, I certainly think that it is an opportunity for HBCUs to set an agenda and not be placed in a position where we are reacting to someone else's agenda. And so if I, in the end, after Tuesday of next week, I will be more definitive about this. If I'm raising my hand saying, yes, I am going to go, it will be with very clear goals in mind. I'm not interested in any photo op opportunity.
Of course.
That's just not who we are at Morgan. And so the first goal would be to ensure that there is a clear appreciation and understanding of the great history, role, legacies, and contributions that historically black colleges have made to the competitiveness of America. That would be the first goal that I would want to pursue in going to this meeting, because there cannot, I don't want any quote-unquote alternative facts to emerge about our institutions that are not necessarily accurate. And then the second is that I have asked my colleagues at Morgan to work with me, and we will produce a 10-page paper of opportunities that that would be before the nation for what we are calling serious investments in the institutions, in infrastructure, in creating research centers that would be about looking at issues impacting our communities, and that would be sustainable long term. So it's those two things in particular that would compel my attending and setting the agenda, not reacting to the agenda. Because if you're not, you know, around the table, you could very well be on the menu.
All right. We don't want to be on the menu. But a proactive stance, obviously, is ideal for you and for your colleagues. But obviously, you understand, as I suspect many of your colleagues understand, that given the first 28 or 29 days of this administration has placed, it becomes a precarious sort of slope to operate on if you are connected in any way to a so-called meeting, if you, as you just outlined, are not proactive and able to establish an agenda for yourself, because you will wind up on the menu, I would suspect, and I think a lot of people would feel that way.
And that's not in any way the direction that I'm going as president of Morgan.
I
paid a lot of attention to this, and we want to make sure that if we are giving an opportunity to shape what the agenda should be, or what the strategic priorities would be, you better believe we're going to take advantage of that.
Of course.
And we're going to ask this federal government for the type of investment in us that would be in line with the investment that they made in 1862 and all of those land-grant institutions that created the North Carolina state universities and the LSUs and the Auburns. We are at that point now where we need another kind of major infusion in what I consider to be the most consequential set of institutions that have dotted the American landscape.
Not to disparage the former president, the 44th president, Barack Obama, but if this meeting does indeed take place, if it unfolds, and the current president does meet in an official capacity with several of HBCU presidents, yourself included, and your other colleagues, it would be something that did not happen during the previous administration, to my knowledge.
That's not necessarily accurate. President Obama appointed me to the White House Advisory Board on HBCUs in 2009. And in September of 2009, the White House holds an annual HBCU conference that takes place over 3 or 4 days.
So he did actually meet in an official capacity with HBCU presidents, because this has been something that's been kind of bandied around.
It depends on how you define that.
And so
did all of the HBCU presidents go to the White House, and did we sit around a long table with an elongated conversation with the president? No.
Okay.
But we all were invited to the White House, and the president spoke to us en masse. And I even carried with me to that meeting a former member of our Board of Regents. But that did happen.
Okay.
Now, of course, President Obama did not sit with the board, mm-hmm. with the White House Initiative Board during the time that I sat on the board. But my recollection is that that meeting did occur in September of 2009.
Well, that's good that we have got at least the record somewhat clear, because there had been, you know, kind of confusion about whether or not the president had actually met with HBCU presidents in an official capacity. And again, it comes down to a definition, I suspect, though. Yeah. Since we're talking about the plight of HBCUs and equitable treatment and the possibility of really kind of restructuring the conversation about where HBCUs are and the future for HBCUs, we would be remiss, and I mean, we have a few minutes left in this first segment, to talk about the coalition lawsuit. I got a report today that said that that the two sides, the coalition side and the state, are still rather far apart as far as money is concerned, how much money should be connected to remedy, if you will. What is your perspective on that, Dr. Wilson? I mean, where we are now with the HBCU coalition lawsuit, and where are we going?
Well, I have to always say that Morgan is not a party to the lawsuit. However, the interests of Morgan are aligned with those of the coalition of the plaintiffs.
Of course.
And so with that in mind, my view on the neglect of Morgan over decades and decades has been well stated and is well known, and it has been shameful and totally inadequate. And it is now high time, past time, for a level of investment to be made in Morgan to enable us to realize our noble mission, which is to be the preeminent public comprehensive urban research university in the state of Maryland, and to raise our hands and be in a position to research and tackle many of the intractable problems facing our city. We are the only public comprehensive research university in the city of Baltimore. And so we want to be a smaller version on the public side to what Johns Hopkins is.
Sure.
What the state was bringing to the table and what the state has brought to the table since I have been president at Morgan has basically been embarrassing.
Mm-hmm.
And it did not even attempt, you know, to address some of these long eras of neglect in investment in Morgan. And so when Judge Catherine Blake ruled in October of 2013 that MHEC, the Maryland Higher Education Commission, and via the state, had enabled traditionally white institutions to duplicate programs,
right,
that were in place at HBCUs, and ordered us into mediation to see if we could come to a conclusion around what the remedy would look like.
Right.
That failed because we were just coming from east on the one side and west on the other.
Right.
And so I'm very hopeful that as a result of the remedy phase of the trial, that we will see an outcome that will recognize this opportunity for investment in Morgan. I, by the way, was the first witness to testify, and my testimony lasted 2 days. And it is very public, and I would urge everyone who is listening to go and get a copy of that testimony, because you will see that I did not miss words. And I'm basically calling upon the state to do what the state should have done 40, 50 years ago.
Generations ago. You also testified during the fall before the Black Caucus in Annapolis. And you very poignantly pointed out that you talked about Morgan State University's library and that it was at least aesthetically very appealing. But because of the lack of resources that have been allocated for HBCU, specifically Morgan, it is more on par with maybe a well-equipped high school library. That is that's a tragedy, I think, in the minds of many people.
It's not taking full advantage of the investment opportunity. And so we have a wonderful library aesthetically, just as, you know, we have a wonderful new business school. But the way the state is funding facilities, it's very taxing on an institution's operating budget. And so when we finish the library, because you get the funding on the capital side differently right. than on the operating side, right. then the question becomes, okay, so now you built this structure. How are you going to operate it? Well, it requires $3-4 million a year to operate it. Mm-hmm. And so we don't get the additional $3-4 million a year from the operating budget. That means that you have to dip into an already overstretched operating budget to try and operate a building that costs $70 million.
Right.
And as a result, a lot of things would go unattended to. And so that's what we're pushing for now, is that, yes, when we get capital facilities on the campus, you have to also provide us with the appropriate amount of resources to enable us to get the appropriate online journals that we need, to have our professors have the databases, the online databases, and the journals and the books and things like that.
Right.
And so we will continue, Sean, to make our case via the legislative process and also in the School of Public Opinion.
Of course. We have to take a quick break. You can hang with us for a little while, David?
Yes, I can hang for a little while.
Okay,
over,
I appreciate that. I appreciate that. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation with Morgan State University President Dr. David Wilson. Stay tuned. You're listening to First Edition. Welcome back to First Edition here on WEAA 88.9. I'm Sean Yose, your host, as we continue our conversation with Morgan State University President Dr. David Wilson. So, Dr. Wilson, I want to ask you about, obviously, an issue that has been pressing to many in the Morgan community, and that is public safety. I mean, we understand that Morgan is a university within a city that has had issues with violence, homicide for decades. So to suggest somehow that Morgan is an island unto itself and not touched by some of the ills that we find ourselves facing in Baltimore City would be unfair at the very best. But how do you want to address whatever concerns students, faculty may have about issues of public safety on the campus of Morgan State University? What are your thoughts?
Public safety at Morgan is our top priority, and we have invested and will continue to invest as many resources as possible in ensuring that we have an adequate police force. We have secured an outside security firm. We have installed security booths on the periphery of the campus. We have upgraded our cameras throughout the campus. We have over 700 cameras throughout the campus. We have instituted escort services for faculty and students who are going from the campus to some places off campus where some of them live. We recently have started discussions with the mayor's office about upgrading significantly the lighting around Morgan, and the city has already started that process, and two streets have already been treated, and the next phase of this will be East Cold Spring to Argonne Drive, where there's going to be a major upgrade of all of the lighting around the campus. Morgan is an open campus. We are a significant part of our city.
More so than many campuses are, quite frankly, as far as the openness of the campus itself.
We are Yes, and some of that has to do with the terrain
and
the way the campus is erected on that terrain. And so we are studying whether through aesthetic treatments we could limit some of the real open spaces in terms of the way we are going to design and place future buildings on the campus and shrubbery and things of that sort. But I also want to give a shout out, Sean, to our current mayor, Catherine Pugh. She, of course, is meeting now with the presidents of all of the city institutions because this is not just a Morgan issue. It's an issue affecting all of higher education in the city of Baltimore. And so just last week, we had a sit-down breakfast, 2 hours or so, with Mayor Pugh. All of the presidents were there, including Commissioner Davis. And so we think we have a real opportunity of working with her to ensure that we are putting in place the kind of strategies around our campus that will ensure their safety in our city. And so a lot of investment that is being made in Morgan, and I like what the mayor is doing in terms of looking at this now as an opportunity to ensure that anchor institutions, you know, like Morgan and Hopkins and Coppin and University of Baltimore and Loyola and Notre Dame, that that we are providing resources to upgrade security in and around those campuses.
In your mind, Dr. Wilson, what is the role, as you see it, in 2017 and beyond, the role of Morgan, as you just mentioned, an anchor institution in this city, specifically on the East Side, but in the city more broadly? How do you visualize the role of Morgan as an anchor institution in a city that has myriad needs and myriad benefits as well? Mm-hmm. But how do you see Morgan's role as a leader institution, for lack of a better phrase?
Morgan's role in the city of Baltimore has been and will always be an institution that is raising its hand to help the city and help the neighborhoods and communities deal with intractable challenges, to deal with lack of economic development in some of those areas, to use the research coming out of the institution to address issues of criminal justice reform, education reform, and then to maintain an opportunity at Morgan for students in this city to come and get a world-class education that in many instances, especially when we're talking about first-generation college-going students, that will enable them to break the cycle of poverty and move into the middle class. And so I like to say that Morgan's role in the city of Baltimore is closely akin to a downsized version of Temple University to North Philadelphia, or Wayne State University to Detroit, or Georgia State University to Atlanta, or the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee to Milwaukee. And so we are that public type of institution in the city of Baltimore, which is why Senator Conway, Joan Carter Conway, just yesterday, and I really applaud her, she has introduced a bill at our urging to now designate Morgan as not just Maryland's urban university, but Maryland's premier public urban research university, and set us in a position where we can realize that mission even more, secure the resources at the state level and at the federal level to do those kinds of things to help our city to become as vibrant as it can be, and to become a place for families to thrive and to recreate and to grow.
Mm-hmm. On that note, though, you mentioned Joan Carter Conway. Obviously, she's been one of the most staunch advocates for Morgan State University during her entire career in the legislature. But are you satisfied with the, you mentioned Mayor Pugh, and you seem satisfied with what she has, the conversations that you have had with her is in regards to Morgan and the understanding the importance that Morgan plays in this city of Baltimore. Are you fully confident that there is enough cooperation, if you will, between, say, for instance, the Baltimore City delegation as a whole, the Black Caucus as a whole, and as far as understanding the importance and relevance of Morgan State University to the city of Baltimore and to, quite frankly, the broader HBCU family across this nation?
First of all, we are very proud of Senator Pugh being a two-time graduate of Morgan. She wears the university very proudly. She understands the critical role that Morgan has played and must play in the continual evolution of this city. We enjoy a good, productive relationship with the Baltimore City delegation. We enjoy a good, productive relationship with the Maryland Congressional Black Caucus. We are developing good relationships with other elected officials because, you know, we are not taking for granted that Morgan's role in this city is only, if you will, the responsibility of the Baltimore City delegation. Mm-hmm. You know, but those elected officials in Frederick County or in Cecil County, it is as much to their advantage to have a vibrant, you know, energetic, world-class public urban institution in Baltimore as it is for the delegation that is under our nose. And so we certainly have a strategy that we are pursuing that is targeting, you know, Baltimore City delegation, but also elected officials who are not necessarily in this region as well. They need to understand the role and the importance of the institution.
In my history of reporting and covering Annapolis over the years, what you just mentioned is something that I don't know if those representatives of those regions that you just named fully understand Morgan's significance, and that's problematic, obviously. From your perspective, what have you been able to do to help them see more clearly the benefit of having Morgan be all the things that it can be for not just obviously the city, but this state?
So I've gone into some of the districts and spent half day in Southern Maryland in some of these districts. And I talk about Morgan in terms of its impact on the state, you know, because we are number one in the state of Maryland in producing African-American engineers. We're number one in producing African-American electrical engineers, number one in industrial engineers, number one in civil engineers. We are number one in architecture. We, you know, are number one, I think, in journalism. And so for these STEM fields in particular, when these individuals come through Morgan, the great majority of them end up remaining in the state and bringing that kind of innovation to places in the state. And so it is in the state's advantage to develop this institution even more, because in so doing, you have more taxes coming in. You have a larger percent of the population with college degrees. You have a larger percent of the population embracing innovation. And that is happening within the largest city in the state. And so the more you develop that, then one can argue the more would be on the table for areas of the state that are less populous. Mm-hmm. And so that's what we try and do. I try and get down as often as I can to these districts and take the message of Morgan with me. I try and do the same thing in the legislature, and I'm down there quite a bit. And my testimony is never just responding to the two or three questions they want me to respond to, but I always see that as an opportunity for further education as well.
I want to come back to, and I want to get to the state of HBCUs generally, but specifically the state of Morgan State and some of the outstanding students that are on this campus and all of that. But I want to come back to one more question about public safety. What would you say? What would you say to students who may be jittery, may feel unsure or insecure about some of the more recent acts of violence against some of the students on the campus? What would be your words to them specifically?
Mm-hmm. So, knock on wood, we have lost, I think, 3 students to violence this year, but none of those losses occurred on the campus.
Right.
They were out in the city. And so we, first of all, are saying to everybody within our university community, here's sort of what you need to be thinking about in terms of how to keep yourself safe. And so a good educational program around that is unfolding at the university. We are continuing to invest in best practice initiatives that we are able to glean from other institutions. Indeed, I commissioned a study to look at some of the best practices of urban universities, and so we're putting those in place as well. We are hopeful that with perhaps some development that might take place around the campus, that is going to further, if you will, create a different kind of climate around Morgan, because we desperately need around Morgan a different kind of economic feel with small shops and restaurants and things of that sort. And so I'm very pleased with the direction that we're going on that. And so those are the things that I would say to our listening community. And I think those are some of the things you might hear other city-based presidents say as well.
Sure. If you're just tuning in, you're listening to First Edition here on WEAA 88.9. Excuse me, I'm Sean Yoes, your host. We're in the studio with me is Dr. David Wilson, president of Morgan State University, talking about the school, talking about the state of HBCUs, period. And I want to ask you, Dr. Wilson, from your perspective as president of Morgan, what is the current state in your mind of HBCUs in America? We understand the enormous contribution that HBCUs have played to the whole notion of American exceptionalism, if you buy into that notion of American exceptionalism. But in 2017, given the current president, given the current status of the country, how do you visualize the plight, or rather the role of the HBCU in the United States?
There are roughly about 105 HBCUs, and Sean, the way I respond to this is that those institutions are not monolithic.
Oh, of course not.
And so you have as much diversity amongst the 105 HBCUs as you have within the rest of higher ed.
It's an important point. Very
absolutely.
Important.
And so it's very hard, to ascribe, certain characteristics to an entire genre when you have 10 of those institutions that are research institutions. So 10 of the 105 are research institutions. And as such, they should be behaving like other research institutions. Mm. And then you have your selective private liberal arts institutions that actually should be behaving in a lot of ways like liberal arts institutions. And so it's not fair to basically take a couple of the private institutions and compare them with a large public research institution
sure.
like Morgan, right? And so that's the first piece. A second is that I do think that some of our private HBCUs or also challenged in the climate in which we find ourselves, because they depend more heavily on private gifts and philanthropic support, and that's why it's very important to protect the great legacies of the institutions, because the last thing you want to do is to send a message to individuals who have the wherewithal to invest in institutions that's not a good place to invest. And so I do have conversations with private HBCU presidents, and some of them are not where they need to be because, you know, almost 90% of their time is out there trying to raise money.
Right.
I think that institutions like Morgan and other HBCUs, I believe that, you know, we have a lot of good days ahead of us. I think the nation is coming back to us more than it is moving away from us. That is, you know, there is a tremendous browning of America occurring.
Right.
There's also quite a few individuals as the nation becomes browner that are poor. And so what HBCUs have proven for 150 plus years is that they can take students like those that will represent the faces of America in the majority in 2032. And they can take them where they are, and they move them where they need to be so that when they come across those stages and get those degrees, they are competitive with anyone, any place, any time, anywhere. And so I think the next 15 years or so, we have to be very, very opportunistic. We have to understand our great value proposition. We have to position our campuses to be the recipients now of this kind of largest kind of support that I'm talking about. Because Harvard is not raising its hands to educate that big swat of the population that would need college degrees.
Indeed not.
And the Big Ten and University of Chicago are not doing that. And it is left up to us to play that critical role in this nation in order for the nation to be competitive long term. And it won't be competitive long term if you don't have more faces like our faces with college degrees that are bringing innovative thoughts, creative thoughts, entrepreneurial spirit to this country. And so when I'm on a panel and I'm talking about the value proposition at Morgan, I don't care who is sitting with me. I don't care who's to my left or who's to my right. I don't care if it's the president of Harvard or the president of MIT or the president of Stanford. You're not bringing anything more to the table in terms of the role you play in higher education in this country than I'm bringing. You may be bringing something different, but it's not greater. And so I think those of us who kind of understand this, and we understand the great opportunity for our institutions, you know, we can't be bashful. We got to get out there, and we got to say that, and we got to behave like we know that you can't have a serious conversation in this country about America's competitiveness long term without HBCUs being at the epicenter of that dialogue.
So as we go forward, we have a few minutes left in the hour. What would you like to highlight as far as where Morgan is right now in 2017 and going forward? We actually interviewed a young man who was recipient of the Schwarzman Scholarship, I believe it was.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Who's going to be traveling to China soon. And those opportunities, one of the narratives of that came out of that conversation with him is that these opportunities, even though they are there, unfortunately, not a lot of people who go to schools like Morgan, go to HBCUs, are aware of these opportunities, and that's obviously a dilemma. But talk about where what you envision for the students on this campus going forward, and opportunities like the young man who's about to go to China.
Here's sort of the way that I envisage this, and I think my students at Morgan know this all too well. You have to be globally competent. You have to be globally and culturally competent, given where the world is today.
Right.
And our students have to understand that this period that we're in right now is fleeting. You know, this is an episode. You know, we're going to come through a little period here, but, you know, the next 15 years, you're going to be in control. And as a result of your being in the majority, you will have to understand the world. You'll have to be culturally competent in leading whatever you're going to lead in Japan or in China or in New York City or in Alabama, wherever you are. And so we have pushed very, very hard to get more of our students on the global stage. And so I was president of the HBCU China Scholarship Network, and we got the country of China to contribute 1,000 scholarships to students at Morgan and other HBCUs to come to China at their expense and study at one of these institutions. And we have lots of students at Morgan taking advantage of that. And so when I came on board, I think we had about 4 or 5 students taking advantage of study abroad opportunities. And now we are like 60 to 70, and I want to get up to about 5 to 10%. Likewise, we have in our strategic plan that we want to grow Morgan to about 10 to 12,000 students, of which about 8 to 9% would be international. We've already achieved that. So we've gone from roughly about 3% of students at Morgan being international to about 9.5%, representing now 70 countries. Because it's important as well for our domestic students to be in the company of students who are coming from different parts of the world. So I guess my concluding comment is that students at Morgan coming through this particular period where the national dialogue seems to be kind of focused only on America, we got to be careful that we don't drink too much of that tea.
Right.
You know, because if you do and you find yourself now not taking advantage of these global opportunities, long term, that could be to your great disadvantage.
Speaking of global opportunities, we also reported a couple of weeks ago about the Yemeni student who had to go home for an emergency and found himself or herself not being able to get back into the country because of this proposed travel ban that has been upheld and not upheld, but put aside by U.S. courts, obviously. So it's not actually in effect. But when that when that manifested itself, when that was presented to you, what was your reaction to find out one of your students, and there may be more than one, was prevented from coming back into the country and completing their education because of the policy of the 45th President of the United States?
Well, you know, first I tried to put myself in the position of the student,
sure,
you know, who was out there trying to get back to continue his studies at Morgan, and what that student must have been feeling, to try and empathize with that. And then I tried everything in my power to do whatever we could to try and aid his getting back into the United States. But the way this executive order was rolled out, that was just impossible. No one could give me in that direction or any other president or chancellor in the country who has students detained. And so when the Ninth Circuit basically stayed the order, and we went through that window there, we communicated with the student. He was sending me emails back and forth saying, hey, you have this window now, and so you can board a flight and get back here. And then at the same time, I called a meeting of all of our international students on campus. It was well attended because there was a high level of angst and anxiety.
Sure.
And they simply wanted to know that their president understood that they loved Morgan, and that Morgan was their institution
you
too.
Mean you, president.
Yes,
you.
I mean, yes, that President Wilson. Yes, that, and they just needed me to affirm the fact that these are Morgan's core values, and we don't discriminate here at Morgan. You know, we don't discriminate against individuals based on their religious beliefs, or any other way, and so that was really healthy for the entire university to hear, and then for me and others who attended that meeting with me to hear back from them as we make our way forward.
So was that student able to get back to the country?
I actually have to check on the status now to see if indeed he was able to board, because the last time I communicated with him, he did not return my email.
Okay.
And so that's on my radar to try and get some intelligence on tonight.
If indeed you do wind up going to this meeting at the White House, if the caveats that you have outlined are manifested, would you come back and report to us and let us know exactly what transpired? I'd be curious to hear from you about that.
I'll be more than happy to do that. I'm a very transparent leader, and I would be more than happy to come back and let you know what happened and the substance of it.
It'll be interesting if it happens, if it happens. Dr. David Wilson is the president of Morgan State University. Dr. Wilson, thank you so much for coming through and speaking to us for this first hour. We appreciate it.
Thank you very much, and I really appreciate the work that you do.
Thank you, sir. I appreciate it. All right, we're going to take a break. When we come back, quite a transition from Dr. David Wilson to the NWA Sports Report, but that's what we do on First Edition. Stay tuned. You're listening to First Edition. Thank you.